He went back to Finn Durandal's apartment because he didn't know where else to go. Finn wasn't there. Brett paced back and forth, chewing on a white knuckle, trying to think what to do. Rose was out of control. Finn's ambitions were out of sight. And he had had enough. Brett stopped pacing. He had had enough. To hell with Finn and Rose and all the other pressures that were eating him alive and making him into the kind of man he'd always despised. The kind who just went along with things he knew were wrong because he was too scared not to. No, it was time for Brett to do what he did best. Run. But he couldn't just leave. He needed ammunition. Something he could take with him that would keep Finn off his back. Something sufficiently incriminating to keep the Durandal from even looking for him. Brett looked thoughtfully at Finn's computer. Breaking into Finn's secret files was no big deal for someone of Brett's wide-ranging talents, especially when he just happened to know a whole bunch of entry codes that Finn didn't know he had. Amazing what you could see over someone's shoulder from the other side of the room if you knew what you were doing. Brett found a set of files that looked particularly interesting, protected by some frankly amateurish firewalls, and opened them up. And that was when Brett came to his second great shock of the day. Finn was planning to use some unnamed allies to track down and ambush every single Paragon, once they were safely isolated from backup, on their great quest. Because the Paragons were the only real threat remaining to Finn's plans. Brett was horrified. He'd always secretly admired the Paragons, not least because they were everything he was not. They were the kind of people he just knew his legendary ancestors would have approved of, while he very definitely was not. Brett had no doubt this threat was real. It was exactly the kind of cold-blooded, logical thing Finn would do. Never mind that these people were his ex-partners and supposedly friends. Never mind the importance of their quest. They were in Finn's way, so they had to go. Brett downloaded the files onto a data crystal and then shut down the computer, after taking steps to ensure no one would ever know he'd been there. And then he got up and did some more pacing back and forth, pausing now and again to kick the furniture. He had to tell someone, but who could he tell? Who would listen to someone like him? Who could he turn to who might not already be one of Finn's people? The Durandal had allies everywhere now, some who knew what he was and some who didn't. Either way, no one was going to believe a proven con man, even with the data crystal. Showing it to the wrong person would be his death warrant. So, Brett did what he always did when faced with danger and a problem he couldn't solve. He ran away. He ran back into the rookery, still the best place for anyone looking to disappear from the world for a while. Brett had a number of bolt holes he'd gone to great pains to keep concealed from Finn, just in case things didn't work out. One of them was a very secret establishment belonging to an old friend, a human-alien hybrid called Nikki 16, who ran a specialist brothel called Loving the Alien. A very private, very discreet operation, serving a very select clientele. Basically, it was a knocking shop for people who liked having sex with aliens. Humans having sex with aliens was extremely illegal, for all kinds of moral, philosophical, and political reasons. Aliens might be equal, but they weren't that equal. So, while establishments like Loving the Alien inevitably existed, they could only thrive safely in the rookery, where no one cared what or who you did, as long as your credit was good. To be fair, most alien species were just as opposed to the practice, for their own complicated reasons. And on the rare occasions when humans and aliens proved interfertile, the hybrid results could only exist safely in places like the rookery. Nikki 16 ran her place, at least partly as an act of rebellion and defiance, making it possible for the like-minded to get together, for a price. And she only sometimes recorded what went on in her soundproofed rooms, for blackmail or retail purposes, because a girl had to make a living, even if she was only partly a girl. Nikki 16 was half-human, half-Najar. 7 feet tall, she was a dark blue-gray color, with interlocking bony plates forming a protective carapace down the length of her back. Her strikingly pretty face was dominated by a smile that stretched almost literally from ear to ear, huge faceted eyes, and a pair of disturbingly hairy antennae rising from her bald skull. Her movements tended to be sudden and jerky, and her two sets of elbows gave her wide theatrical gestures an impressive breadth and impact. Her sheer presence could be disturbing and even intimidating, and she gave off a sharp, spicy aroma that sometimes brought tears to the eye. But on the other hand, she had six magnificent breasts. She also had more metal piercings than most people felt comfortable contemplating, that chimed and jangled as she moved. She was warm and friendly and very touchy-feely, and entirely cold-blooded when it came to making business decisions. She and Brett had been friends and rivals and partners for many years, and had worked together on many cons and stings, a few of which were still legendary, even in the rookery. Loving the Alien was one of the few places where Brett could hope to crash for a while with a price on his head and still feel safe. And of course, no one who saw him there would turn him in, because then they'd have to explain what they were doing in such a place. On the other hand, it had to be said that Nikki wasn't always glad to see him.
Oh, shit. What the hell are you doing here? Every time you show up here, it means trouble. I'd ban you if I thought it would do any good. Who have you got mad at you this time?
Pretty much everybody.
Brett slumped into the nearest comfortable chair and looked longingly at the drinks cabinet.
I just need somewhere to go to ground for a while I figure out what to do next. Any chance of a drink, Nikki? Oh, I could murder a drink.
Don't get comfortable. You're not staying. All my rooms are full, and with things the way they are these days, I can't afford to turn away business. And no, you can't sleep in my cellar again. I'm having it turned into a fun and games room, and decent soundproofing is costing me an arm and a mandible. And you missed my last birthday.
Don't be like this, Nikki. I'm in real trouble this time.
That's what you always say.
And usually I'm right. Come on, Nikki. If I hadn't overseen those last few scams for you, you'd never gotten enough money together to set up this place. You owe me.
And you've never ceased to hold that over my head, particularly when you need something. Hell. I could never say no to you, Brett. I always did have a weakness for charming, feckless bastards with more ambition than sense. You can sleep in my room for a while, and you can lose that look right now. Sleep is all you'll be doing there. You couldn't afford me these days. And try and keep to yourself while you're here. You know how my customers spook when they see an unfamiliar face.
She poured him a large brandy, thrust it ungraciously into his hand, and then cocked her head unnaturally far to one side as she studied him thoughtfully.
Something spooked you, Brett. It's been a long time since I saw you looking this shit scared. What's happened?
Trust me, Nikki. You really don't want to know.
That bad, eh? Last I heard, you were working for the Durandal. Good gig, by all accounts. Part of this great and glorious scheme he's been peddling all over the rookery. Not that I want anything to do with it. Always knew he was too good to be true, that one. Don't tell me you've had a falling out with the one real success story you've ever been involved with.
Everyone has a line they won't cross.
Brett looked at her with such painful honesty that for a moment she hardly recognized him.
It seems I have found mine, Nikki. A bit of a shock at my advanced age to discover I have something disturbingly like a conscience. I'm not a bad man, Nikki. Not really. A crook, a con man, and a bit of a scumbag on occasion. But I never thought of myself as a bad man. Until now. Some of the things I've done have been a party to in Finn's employ. I have to wonder if I'll ever be able to wash the stench off. And no, I'm not going to tell you what. For your own protection. And because you're my friend, and I want you to at least be able to sleep at night without nightmares.
Nikki knelt down beside him and put a long, comforting arm across his shoulders.
You're safe here, Brett. I won't let them get you.
I can't stay here long. People will be looking for me. And if Finn even suspected you knew what I know, he'd burn this place down with you and everyone else in it.
Then you'll need to get off planet. Put Logris behind you till things have calmed down again. These things pass, they always do. Want me to arrange a new face and ID so you can buy a ticket?
No good. Finn's got people everywhere these days. No matter who you got to do the work, someone would talk. I'm gonna have to steal a ship. Any ideas?
Well, at least you're still thinking big.
Nikki frowned, her antennae twitching thoughtfully.
There's always the Hereward, a luxury racing yacht currently standing empty on the pads at the main starport. Fast as hell and twice as comfortable. No weapons, but you can't have everything. As it happens, I've got the captain and owner upstairs hip-deep in a Thardian. Easy enough to acquire the ship's access codes from his wallet while he's preoccupied. You want me to arrange it?
If you would, Nikki.
Anything to get you out of here, darling.
She rose to her full height and left. Brett gulped down the last of the brandy. A new world meant starting over again from scratch. But there was always an opening for someone with his kind of skills. There were always suckers, just sitting up and begging to be fleeced. Brett considered the data crystal burning a hole in his pocket, and wondered what the hell he was going to do with it. He ought to tell someone what he knew before he left, if only so the information wouldn't be lost if Finn managed to have him killed before he got off-world. There were any number of media shows who would broadcast the data happily enough without any provenance, but they were the kind of shows no one took seriously anyway. He needed someone honest and respectable he could turn the crystal over to. But unfortunately, Brett didn't know people like that. He was still turning the matter over and over in his mind, and trying to work up the energy to go looking for another drink. Rose Constantine stalked into the parlor. He got ready to run, but she already had her gun in her hand, and he knew he'd never make it. He thought about jumping her, and immediately thought better of it. So, he just froze where he was, gasping for breath, his hands shaking, and hoped Nikki wouldn't come back until it was all over.
How did you find me?
Brett was surprised at how calm he sounded. There was a certain peace to knowing you'd finally run out of options.
Finn has a file on you. You'd be surprised at all the things he knows about you, about all sorts of people.
Nothing that bastard does surprises me anymore. He's planning to ambush every paragon on the quest. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know. And I don't care. Is that why you broke and ran? You care about the strangest things, Brett.
Do it. Get it over with. Kill me and get out of here. No one else has to die. Surely you've killed enough people for one day.
There's no such thing as enough.
Rose smiled for the first time, with her savage, scarlet rosebud mouth.
Finn sent me here. He wants you dead. In fact, he was very specific about how he wants you to die. I think he wants to send a message to anyone else who might consider running out on him. I have to say that what he had in mind was so appallingly nasty that even I was impressed. I don't think I've ever seen him quite so angry. He wants me to bring him back your heart as proof of the kill. But I've decided that I'm not going to do that, because I like you, Brett. So I'm going to run away with you.
Brett hadn't thought it was possible for him to feel even more horrified, but that did it. Still, freaked as he was, he had enough sense not to say it.
That's nice, Rose. I'm sure I'll feel much safer with you around. But you can't kill any more bars. Really, you can't. It attracts attention. And if we're going to run, we've got to get off-world before Finn and his people discover we've joined forces. Even you can't fight a whole army. I've made arrangements to steal a racing yacht right off the main pads. Is that all right with you?
Of course. You understand about these things. Leaving Logris is the only sensible thing to do. This world belongs to Finn now. Even if a few people haven't worked that out yet. I never liked the Durandal. He's weird. I know you think I'm strange, Brett, and maybe I am, but trust me, Finn is crazier than I will ever be. I at least care about a few things, and a few people. Finn doesn't care about anything, possibly not even himself, and that's what makes him really dangerous. He will be king, and then the whole empire will be his to do with as he pleases. Then where will we run? I think we need to join up with Louis Deathstalker, also on the run, in case you hadn't heard. He is possibly the only man who fights as well as I do, and he has even more reasons than we do to bring about the Durandal's downfall. We will be stronger and safer together.
If we can find him, sure. That's good thinking, Rose, but we can't afford the time to go looking for him.
We won't have to. He will be looking to leave Logris too, which means he'll be looking for his ship, just like us. I wouldn't be surprised if we fell over each other at the starport. Where were you thinking of going after we leave Logris?
I hadn't thought that far ahead. Rimworlds, I suppose. Terra or no, not very civilized and definitely short on the comforts. But the farther we get from Finn, the better.
I could always stay. Kill Finn myself. I'd enjoy killing Finn.
No, Rose! You can bet he's got plans in place to protect himself from you. He doesn't trust you anymore if he ever did. His security people would shoot you down from a safe distance before you got anywhere near him. He sent you after me to see what you'd do.
Oh, damn! He probably had you followed.
Of course he did. I killed the fellow right outside Finn's apartment and stuck his head on a parking meter. No one else tried to follow me. I'd know. You mustn't worry so, Brett. We were meant to be together, you and I. Nothing is ever going to part us.
If I had any sense, I'd kill myself right now and get it over with.
Louis Deathstalker and Jessamine Flowers went to visit the Dust Plains of Memory to learn the truth at last, the history from which legends derived. Louis wasn't sure he wanted that after so many disappointments and heartbreaks, but he needed to know. So he hardened his heart and went anyway. The two of them traveled across the city, hidden behind hollow disguises, using public transport where possible, sticking to the most traveled routes, hiding in plain sight. Samuel Chevron had smuggled them out of the Bloody Tower by an old hidden route that only he seemed to know about. And the moment they were outside, he gave Louis a notebook containing directions and access codes written personally on paper, just like in all the old spy shows, so that the contents couldn't be scanned by remote security checks. The handwriting was clear and old-fashioned. Chevron and Vaughn disappeared while Louis and Jessamine were still studying it. The instructions led them down into the labyrinth of ancient tunnels that still existed under the Parade of the Endless from before Lionstone's day. The service and maintenance tunnels, tucked away out of sight so the city's populace wouldn't have to see the hard, grubby work that kept the city gleaming and perfect. Most of this work was done by robots these days, of course, run by Shub on subroutines. None of them paid Louis and Jessamine any attention as they made their way deeper and deeper into the labyrinth. Chevron's access codes opened most of the closed doors that blocked their way, and Louis's skeleton key took care of the rest. Louis worried about Jessamine. She was being very quiet. It occurred to him that she'd lost even more than he had, so he did his best to just take care of business and not bother her. There would be time for talks and discussions later, when they were both safely off-planet. Time then to decide what they were going to do with their lives. They came at last to the old elevators Chevron described in his notebook, elevators Louis was surprised to find he recognized from the quality vid soap. In Lionstone's day, they led down to the private tube stations that were the only way of approaching Lionstone's old court. The stations and the elevators were supposed to have been destroyed long ago. Instead, they were bright and shining, clearly well-maintained and often used, guarded by men with guns in anonymous uniforms and very practical-looking armor. They covered Louis and Jessamine with drawn energy guns from the moment they appeared, but the passwords Chevron had provided made them instantly back down. The guards actually became obsequious, smiling and bowing and doing everything but tug their forelocks. They mentioned the Shadow Court and the Hellfire Club, and one of them actually winked at Louis. He just nodded stiffly and said nothing.
Who the hell is Chevron? How does he know so much? Could he really be a part of foul organizations like these? Could we be walking into a trap?
The train waiting at the empty platform didn't look anything like the ones Lewis had seen on the quality soap. Instead of the luxurious coaches of fiction, weighed down by every comfort under the sun, Lewis and Jessamine found themselves facing a solid steel bullet with only the one recessed door and shutters covering all the windows. But both the centuries-old train and the platform looked absolutely spotless, as though they were used on a regular basis. The door opened as they approached. Lewis made Jessamine wait on the platform while he went in first and looked suspiciously about him. But there were only empty, reasonably comfortable seats and no signs of any other passengers. He beckoned to Jessamine, and she stepped quickly aboard. They sat down together, the door slid shut, and the train moved smoothly off. Lewis bit his lip and kept looking about him, more than a little awed at riding in a conveyance out of history. He wondered whether Owen had ever ridden in a train like this, to visit the Empress Lionstone and her awful court. Jessamine clung tightly to his arm, looking straight ahead, unusually subdued and quiet. Lewis wondered if he should be comforting and encouraging her, but he felt strangely numb, overcome by recent events. So much had happened, so much had changed. It was all he could do to keep moving, keep following some kind of plan. And he had to wonder again if this was how Owen had felt when the Empress outlawed him, took away his sensible, ordered life, and sent him on the run. The door slid open, but this time Jessamine refused to wait behind while Lewis went first. Her grip on his arm was painfully tight as they stepped out onto the platform and looked around them. There were no other travelers, no guards or guides, only a series of illuminated arrows that appeared silently, floating a few inches above the platform, pointing off down a featureless steel tunnel. There was nowhere else to go, so Lewis and Jessamine followed the arrows, more of which kept appearing, always a few feet ahead of them. The air was hot and dry and still, full of a vague but disturbing tension. The tunnel walls were almost organically smooth and curved, as though they were walking through the guts of the city. One tunnel led to another, and to another, always sloping discernibly downwards, until finally Lewis and Jessamine turned a sharp corner and found themselves looking out over a great sea of dust. It stretched away before them, apparently forever, too colorless even to be properly gray, under a coolly glowing, featureless sky. Logically, Lewis knew there had to be an end to the dust ocean somewhere, just as there had to be a cavern roof somewhere above, but the illusion was perfect. It felt exactly as though he had come to another place, another world, and perhaps he had.